Today is Tuesday, May 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Ruofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, European Union leaders agree to cut 90% of oil imports from Russia by the end of this year.
I'm very glad that the leaders were able to agree in principle on the sanctions package. This is very important. Thanks to this,
U.S. President Joe Biden marks Memorial Day by stressing the importance of fighting for democracy.
Today, as a nation, we undertake a sacred ritual to reflect and remember the lives that each of those silent markers represent.
And Afghan women turn to home business to care for their families amid harsh economic conditions. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. European Union leaders agreed to cut 90% of oil imports from Russia by the end of this year, European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said early on Tuesday. Von der Leyen added the remaining 10% will be temporarily exempt from the embargo so that landlocked Hungary, which was the main holdout for a deal, along with Slovakia and the Czech Republic that are all connected to the southern leg of the pipeline, have access which they cannot easily replace.
I'm very glad that the leaders were able to agree in principle on the sanctions package. This is very important. Thanks to this, Council should now be able to finalize a ban on almost 90% of all Russian oil imports by the end of the year. This is an important step forward. Now left over is the around about 10 or 11% that are covered by the southern Druzhba. And indeed, here we have agreed this is for the moment being exempted. We have agreed to that the Council will revert to the topic as soon as possible in one way or the other. So this is a topic where we'll come back to and where we will still have to work on. But it is a big step forward, what we did today. So this is good that we now de-swift the Sberbank. There is a ban on insurance and reinsurance of Russian ships by EU companies, a ban on providing Russian companies with a whole range of business services, and very important, the suspension of broadcasting in the European Union of three further Russian state outlets that were very typically spreading broadly the misinformation that we have witnessed over the last weeks and months.
That's European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen. Russian troops pushed further into key eastern Ukrainian city and fought street by street with Kyiv forces Monday. The mayor said the battle had left the city in ruins and driven tens of thousands of people from their homes. Military analysts painted the fight for Severodonetsk as part of a race against time for the Kremlin. The city is key to Russian efforts to complete the capture of the eastern industrial region of the Donbas quickly, before more Western arms arrive to bolster Ukraine's defense. Weapons from the West have already helped Kyiv forces toward a Russian advance on the capital in the early weeks of the war. That failure forced Moscow to withdraw, regroup, and pursue a more limited objective of seizing the Donbas. Prominent Ukrainian anti-corruption campaigners said they have seen no signs their armed forces are misusing Western military supplies in the 3 months since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, a country long perceived as among the world's most corrupt. In May, interview with VOA, an official says the National Anti-Corruption Bureau had not opened any investigation into high-level corruption in the Ukrainian military since the full-scale Russian invasion started on February 24th. VOA's Michael Lippin and Igor Shikineke wrote the article, and Flashpoint's Ukraine's host Steve Miller spoke with Lippin about it to learn more.
Ukraine does have a couple of governmental agencies that deal with those issues. One of them is called the National Agency on Corruption Prevention. That organization, NACP, it develops regulations that are meant to prevent corruption in the public sector, the private sector. Then there's another agency called the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, or NABU. That's the one that actually investigates cases of corruption and prepares cases for prosecution. It doesn't prosecute people itself. That is the mission of a third agency called the Specialized Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office, or SAPO. That's the one that actually can indict suspects and prosecute cases. So there are a couple of different departments and they sort of share different responsibilities.
It's a whole lot of alphabet soup, it sounds like, with all the different acronyms to keep the organization straight. So given that there are three different entities responsible for different portions of keeping track of assets and making sure that corruption is mitigated, can you kind of refresh our collective memory as to why Ukraine has this reputation as being a state where corruption has in the past run rampant?
The creation of these different governmental departments is partly a result of Ukraine's poor historical record of corruption that goes back many years. In fact, up to 2014, corruption in Ukraine's defense sector was rampant. Ukraine historically produced and exported weapons and military hardware to other countries, but it wasn't really giving its own armed forces the best gear. So in 2014, when Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula and encouraged pro-Russian separatists in the eastern Donbass region to basically occupy a chunk of territory, the very poorly resourced Ukrainian military couldn't put up a fight and couldn't stop Russia from doing those things. And Ukraine had a very poor ranking in Transparency International's global perceptions of corruption index. Ukraine was ranked 144 out of 180 countries back in 2013. That is a very influential global survey of how corruption is perceived in various countries. And Ukraine's ranking did go up a bit to 122 out of 180 countries in Transparency International's latest survey from 2021. So, you know, Ukraine is still in the bottom third of all countries, but there was an improvement in the last 8 years because the U.S., Canada, and other partners of Ukraine were actually working with the Ukrainian government and the military to try to make them more efficient and weed out corruption and basically make them better able to resist the Russians in the east of the country.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller. U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday marked Memorial Day and emphasized the importance of fighting for democracy in the Ukraine-Russian war. Before his remarks, Biden walked alongside U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and then laid a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Today, as a nation, we undertake a sacred ritual to reflect and remember. Because if we forget, the lives that each of those silent markers represent, mothers, fathers, siblings, spouses, children, if we forget what they sacrificed, what they made, so that our nation might endure, strong, free, and united, then we forget who we are. Memorial Day is always a day where pain and pride are mixed together. We all know it sitting here. But for so many of you, as is with Jill and me, the hurt is wrapped around the knowledge that your loved one was part of something bigger, bigger than any of us. They chose a life of purpose. I promise you the day will come when the memory of your loved one, your patriot, will bring a smile to your lip before it brings a tear to your eye. That's when you know you're going to make it. And in this moment, when a war of aggression is once more being waged by Russia to snuff out the freedom, the democracy, the very culture and identity of neighboring Ukraine, we see so clearly all that's at stake. Freedom has never been free. Democracy has always required champions. Today, in the perennial struggle for democracy and freedom, Ukraine and its people are on the front lines fighting to save their nation. But their fight is part of a larger fight that unites all people. It is a fight that so many of the patriots whose eternal rest is here in these hallowed grounds were part of. A battle between democracy and autocracy, between liberty and repression, between appetites and ambition of a few forever seek to dominate the lives and liberties of many. A battle for essential democratic principles. Ladies and gentlemen, today we remember and we reaffirm freedom is worth the sacrifice.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. The U.N. Security Council has welcomed the holding of legislative elections in Lebanon on May 15th, despite what they called the, quote, challenging circumstances, unquote. The council called for the swift formation of a new inclusive government and the urgent implementation of previous outlined tangible reforms. They include the swift adoption of an appropriate budget for 2022 that would enable the quick conclusion of an agreement with the IMF to respond to the demands of the Lebanese population. Joe Macaron, a Lebanese-American political analyst, explained the council's call and concern to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawy.
The election is behind us, and there is no clear majority. It's mostly a parliament of minorities. So I think there's a concern in the international community that the ability to form a government soon, because we have presidential election coming up in October, and there's increasing doubts that no government can be formed before. And this election also might not be held on time, because we'll have an impasse on who could emerge as a consensus candidate at the end. So I think the Security Council is basically expressing those concerns, that if there's no government, the caretaker government cannot pass reforms. If there's no budget, which outlines clearly what to do with the electricity problem, who's going to pay for the loss, whether the state or the banks or the depository who lost the money in their accounts. So there's a lot of questions that are still unanswered. And the political stalemate, I think, might delay having not only a serious debate, but the space to take actions.
The UN Security Council also called upon all Lebanese parties to implement a tangible policy of disassociation from any external conflicts as an important priority spelled out in previous declarations, in particular the 2012 Baabda Declaration. Can you explain why the UN Security Council would ask Lebanese parties to do that?
The issue of disassociation has been recurring in Lebanese politics since 2005, at least. And now I think there's increasing concerns, because in addition to the Iranian influence, we see a surge of Saudi influence been trying to play a significant role. And obviously, we have the U.S. role and the French role. And there are concerns that maybe if there's increasing polarization, that we might see more Iranian-Saudi confrontation if the bilateral talks didn't work well in Iraq and Yemen, that they might use Lebanon as a theater for their confrontation. So I think there's nothing new in this. It's mostly a message for key political parties that they should respect the sovereignty, maintain some stability in the system. But I don't see this happening. Obviously, the polarization will increase moving forward, given how the makeup of the new parliament, given the regional context. So I'm not surprised by this call, but I don't see that it will have to be heard by the main political parties.
Did the election change the balance of power, especially vis-a-vis Hezbollah?
There's not a big significant shift. Hezbollah lost the big majority they had in the last election, but they still have at least a simple majority. The opposition against Hezbollah is not as much as strong as before, because Saad Hariri and the Future Movement that Trump not run. So the Sunni vote is now dispersed between multiple players. They lost, but they are still the most potent political power. And they still have control over institutions. The parliament has never been a very decisive institution in Lebanese politics. It's not where decisions are made. It's not where the main power is held. And we have the new players, which is the uprising candidates who also won around 13 seats. So yes, there's a new makeup, but the major balance of power in the country that runs the political system is still entrenched, is still there. So I don't see, if we look at the larger trend, I don't see like a big shift in the country politics.
That's Joe Macaron, a Lebanese-American political analyst, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El Shenawy. In other news, Roman Abramovich has completed the sale of Chelsea Football Club to a consortium funded by Los Angeles Dodgers part owner Todd Boehly. The price is $3.2 billion. That is the highest ever for a sports team. Abramovich's 19-year tenure ended after he had to sell the club following being sanctioned over his links to Russian President Vladimir Putin after the invasion of Ukraine. Chelsea has been operating under a government license since Abramovich's assets were frozen in March. The British government approved the sale last week after ensuring that Abramovich could not profit from it. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Many Afghan women who lost jobs after the Taliban seized power in the country are now trying to support their families by running home businesses. That's what Shataba Jalal is doing, and her business requires a very special skill. Saliha Ahmadzai has the story, narrated by Anna Ball.
The only way Shataba Jalal can help support her family is to run a business in her home.
The Taliban are the reason that we are staying home. We can't work outdoors. They won't even let us walk on the streets without a male family member with us. Since I'm forced to stay home, I thought let's start a silkworm farm in my home with my husband. We bought silkworms and now raising them.
Shataba lives in the western Afghan province of Herat. The silkworms she and her husband raise at their house produce silk, which they sell in the local market. But the money they make is much less than the $300 a month Shataba earned at her job before the Taliban takeover. The silkworm business will bring in less than $800 a year, she says, but at least she has a way to make money.
A woman who has no male member of the family or a single woman, how do they survive? They had jobs as teachers in schools or public service. Now nothing.
Shataba, who is 27, has some college education and is a mother. Before the Taliban returned to power, she worked for non-governmental organizations in Afghanistan. Shataba hopes the international community will continue to press the Taliban to lift restrictions on women and reopen secondary schools to girls.
I personally wish to get my freedom back like I had in the past and to continue my activities.
If the Taliban refuses to lift their restrictions on girls' education and women's freedom to work and move around freely, Shataba says many Afghan women will be forced to leave the country. For Safiyula Ahmadzai in Herat, Afghanistan, Anne Ball, VOA News.
The Chadian government says clashes last week between gold miners in the country's north left more than 100 people dead. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
The area is home to many unregulated mines where people go to search for gold. Chad's Minister of Defense said Monday that according to a government fact-finding mission, more than 100 people were killed and 40 others injured in the fighting. Minister Dawood Yahya Ibrahim said the fighting broke out at night in the mining sites but did not identify the cause of the violence. Chad's communication minister said last week that the clashes were between Arabs who crossed the border from Libya and the Tama community who hail from eastern Chad. Chadian authorities have suspended informal mining operations in Kauri Pagodi and evacuated people from the area. There was no indication that terrorists or criminal groups played a role in the violence. Chad is involved in a fight against terrorism and rebel groups who threaten to topple the interim government, led by the son of late President Idris Deby. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Science in a Minute.
The James Webb Space Telescope's mirrors are all aligned. Its science instruments are being fine-tuned and will soon begin making observations. The Webb team anticipates the beginning of the state-of-the-art telescope's science mission when the first observational data arrives. Many investigations are planned for the Webb telescope. According to NASA, among the first to be studied will be two hot and rocky exoplanets. One of the exoplanets to be studied will be the tidally locked 55 Cancri E, which NASA says is a super-hot super-Earth located 40 light-years away. The other planet is called LHS 3844b, which is a bit cooler super-Earth that is situated 48 light-years away. NASA says these observations will be part of the space telescope's Cycle 1 General Observers Program. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
And to all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In advance of the May meeting of the World Health Assembly, the WHA, which is the decision-making body of the World Health Organization, the WHO, Secretary of State Antony Blinken strongly advocated for Taiwan to be allowed to participate as an observer and lend its expertise to the solution-seeking discussions. For most of the past 50 years, Taiwan participated robustly in certain UN specialized agencies where statehood is not a requirement. Recently, however, its engagement in these fora has been constrained. In a written statement, Secretary Blinken noted that today's unprecedented health threats demand close international cooperation. The annual meeting of the World Health Assembly is an opportunity, he said, to drive cooperation towards ending the acute phase of the COVID-19 pandemic and advancing global health and global health security. Inviting Taiwan to attend the WHA as an observer would exemplify the WHO's commitment to an inclusive approach to international health cooperation and health for all. At a press briefing, State Department spokesperson Ned Price pointed out that Taiwan's expertise and approaches in the realm of global health and beyond that realm as well can benefit the world. He noted that the WHO broke years of precedent at the 70th World Health Assembly in 2017 when it failed to invite a Taiwanese delegation to attend as an observer, a failure that has been maintained every year since then. As we continue to battle a pandemic, as we continue to confront other public health threats, Taiwan's isolation from the world's preeminent global health forum itself represents a serious health concern, spokesperson Price said. We believe that Taiwan's significant public health expertise, its technical and technological capabilities, its democratic governance, its resilience in the face of COVID-19, and its robust economy offer considerable resources to inform the WHA's deliberations, and we believe there is no reasonable justification to exclude its participation. Secretary Blinken declared that the United States will continue to support Taiwan's membership in international organizations where statehood is not a requirement and encourage Taiwan's meaningful participation in organizations where its membership is not possible in line with our One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communiques, and the six assurances.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.